Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals.
Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. This is our first episode in September, a time of year that I absolutely love. It feels like after a summer of fun, freedom, a lack of routine, a bit of chaos, maybe a little bit too much indulgence, and definitely in my experience this summer, it feels like the right time to pause, to take a breath, and to refocus. It's back to school, it's back to work, it's energy, and I absolutely love it. It's also a good time to consider, with 5 months left of the year, which things you'd maybe like to conclude or maybe change before the end of this year. As always, the aim of this podcast is to motivate, to encourage you, the listeners. I want you to learn from all the incredible people that I get to talk to on this show and to implement positive changes into your career, relationships, finances, health, every other aspect of your life. So with that in mind, I couldn't think of a better guest to kickstart September to help us all get our mindset into a place that is positive, curious, more confident, and ready to take action. So welcome to the podcast, Berthold Gunster.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
I'm so glad you could join us. Where are you based today?
I'm based in Utrecht in Holland. And actually in Holland, we would say Berthold Gunster, but you wouldn't be able to pronounce this. But it's nice to be with you, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. So let's dive straight into my long list of questions. Mm-hmm. Your best-selling book, Flip Thinking, teaches the life-changing art of transforming problems into opportunities. So could you start, I suppose, by explaining the concept of flip thinking?
Yeah, well, the essence is that you, as soon as you are encountered with a problem, your tendency is to solve it. You know, we want to get rid of problems. They feel like annoying things, hindrances, things we want to get away. And so the idea of omdenken or flip thinking, or it's called omdenken in Dutch, omdenken or flip thinking, is that you can use a problem to flip it and to change it into your advantage, to make a possibility out of it. So you don't solve it. Solving problems is something completely different from omdenken or flip thinking problems.
And can you give us an example, like a common thing that people try, a problem that people often think, okay, I have to solve this instead of maybe looking for that opportunity?
Right, let's start as simple as possible, because making things simple is more difficult than making things difficult, which is actually quite simple in life to make things difficult. Well, the most simple example would be if it's raining, right? It's raining today, right? You could consider this as a problem and try to solve it by taking an umbrella or stay inside, and then the rain doesn't bother you. So the problem is solved. Nothing wrong with that in life to solve problems, by the way. But you could also do like children do, and children are in a way more creative in dealing with problems, like dance in the rain. And when you dance in the rain, then the rain is not a problem, but an opportunity, something you like, something you desire. So by flip thinking problems, you don't want to get rid of them, but you want more of the problem. You desire the problem in a way and do something with it, of course.
Mm. And you mentioned children. I think there's some people, would you agree, who naturally have more of this optimistic tendency in life. So when they are, you know those people, perhaps if you're in a group setting at work, there'll be people who, you know, they always look for problems. They always look for barriers. Yeah. They'll always raise their hand and say, oh, but we can't do it this. Oh, have you, you know, almost like I call them handbrakes, uh-huh. People who put the handbrake on everything.
Yep.
And then there's other people who will, I suppose, not necessarily find solutions, but yeah, have more of a creative, you know, find different ways, find different routes. They'll give option A, B, C, right. D, E, and keep going. And do you think that is something people can learn if it's not their natural tendency to think that way?
Yeah, I agree. But I think it would be better to say that they have to unlearn the programs that makes them stuck in reality instead of learning something new. Because I have the conviction that we all are born as children with the optimistic view in life that things are what they are and you can play with it. You can investigate them, and you can make fun of them. So this is, I think, an inherent human capacity we all have, and it's buried under by a lot of people have buried it under a layer of how things should be, on how you should live, or what is expected of you, or what do you, or what you expect of yourself, and all these limitations prevent you from being finding the child we all have in ourselves. So it's something you don't have to learn. It's more about unlearning things, I think. Mm.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And in your book, you talk about the importance of asking trigger questions to stimulate creative thinking. So could you talk to us about trigger questions and how they can lead us to a new perspective?
Yeah, I think the I call this the magical question of flip thinking, of omdenken. And the question could be, is the problem the intention? So is the problem I'm encountered with, I'm facing, is this problem, could this problem be the intention? Well, for the brain, this is an absurd question, because how can a problem be the intention? You know, problem are things you want to get rid of. So by asking yourself this question, you stimulate yourself, you force yourself to investigate whether a problem could give you something. And only by asking this, you might say, counterintuitive or counterinstinctive question, new ways of thinking, new path of thinking might be opened. So is the problem the intention? When I'm losing my hair as a man, which you might consider as something annoying, you don't want to lose hair, right? You want to stay young. Oh, we all want to stay young, don't we? But by asking yourself the question, could losing my hair be the intention? You might come up the idea as embracing being bald as your new fashion, you know, like Bruce Willis did, another very attractive man did. So they embrace the problem of losing their hair and make something new out of it.
I think as an entrepreneur, I'll be honest, I think my mindset, I'm quite, you know, I look for opportunities as an entrepreneur. That is something I think I've always had innately within me. And recently I had a conversation with somebody who works in the corporate world, and her organization was making some people redundant, and she had the option to choose to be made redundant and essentially, you know, receive a redundancy package, so receive some money and change her career. And she said that really she hasn't been enjoying her work that much, but she really was unsure about this decision. And the example that you just gave then is almost like I was kind of talking it through with her and saying, well, you know, what, you know, is this an opportunity for you to actually start something new? And actually it's kind of presented itself because, yeah, your company's making people redundant. And actually it was still, she was in this limbo. And I think sometimes if the decision had been made for her, if, you know, if someone just came in and said, you've been made redundant, I know she would have, eventually she would have been like, okay, this is a good thing, because now I want to change my career, I want to do something new. But because it wasn't made for her, she kind of went back and forth. And in the end, she said, oh, you know, I'm going to stay for a bit longer in her job. And as I say, because I'm an entrepreneur, of course, I always want to encourage, and not everybody should be an entrepreneur, but I think sometimes when these so-called problems arise, it is, in theory, we can talk about it, but when we actually have to make that decision and make, oh, this is a new opportunity, it can be really difficult to action in real life.
Right. So do you have a question on this, or do you want me to react on this?
Yeah. What advice would you, I suppose, have given to that friend or to anyone who thinks, yeah, I know this sounds good, a problem could be an opportunity, but when it's in my life and
I'm
feel
afraid,
stressed by it.
It's terrifying. Question one might ask oneself, a lot of times I think people experience a problem not because they don't know what they really want, but because they really know what they really want. So the problem is not what do I want, but the problem is, am I afraid, or do I have the courage to take a decision? So in your example, your friend, she really knows actually what she wants. So the problem is not what she wants, the problem is that she doesn't dare to make a decision. So what helps me to be brave and to take such a decision and to make it your own responsibility is what a friend told me. In life, now and then you have to create a vacuum, a space where nothing happens and you don't know what might be. And the more vacuum you are able to create, the more attraction you have to your environment, because things go to vacuums. You know, this is what things tend to do. So only if your friend allows herself to make a decision, step out of her job, and then really doesn't know what to do in that moment, then creativity can arise, because in vacuums, things happen. And as long as your life is filled with a lot of things you have to do, you should do, you're overthinking things, then nothing creative can happen there.
Yeah, yeah, I really like the idea. The vacuum, it's like the space, isn't it? The space to actually start something.
The empty space. An empty space is a space full of opportunities, you might say.
Yes, and also that you mentioned fear, because I think for many people, the modern world is, as you said, back to back, busy, 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 always full. And actually people have a fear of doing nothing, of having space where they say, I have nowhere to go. I don't have to be at this place at this time with this person. Solitude, being by themselves. I know some people, they really don't enjoy solitude, and we've made our lives so busy.
Yep.
You know, it's interesting when you mentioned the space for creativity, because we can't be creative when we're rushing from one thing to the next thing all day.
No, we need sleep, we need rest, we need nothing. We need not knowing what we want. We need time to contemplate.
Yeah. And you mentioned the idea of unlearning already, but could you talk to us about why unlearning is important, especially in, you know, a rapid changing world? There's so many things, I suppose, that we're being told to learn, you know, new technologies, new transportation, new updates, everything, you know, you've got to keep up to date. I hear people in the work that I do talking a lot about, you know, when an industry is disrupted, say, for example, with an AI, a new tool, you have to be the first to learn it. You have to know everything. So I think it's very interesting to hear about how unlearning could also be important in the modern world.
Yeah, because we all get these programs, you know, convictions, ideas on what we should be, on how life should be, on how things should go. And these things are fine as long as theory and practice are aligned with one another. But as we are living, like you said, in a rapidly changing world, theories very soon become old. Or not working anymore. So you have to know what you know, and you have to know what kind of expectations you have of yourself, of the world, that don't fit to the world anymore. So unlearning becomes more and more important as the world is changing so rapidly as it does. Because your old convictions, they're sitting in the way.
Yeah. How do you think we could help someone who, let's say they're an older generation, maybe that's a parent, maybe that's a boss,
I'm 64, right? So watch your words, but you're
someone who I feel like,
I feel so young.
Yeah, and your energy and your mind and your open-mindedness, I suppose. So for somebody who maybe is working with someone who is maybe it's a senior person at work, maybe it's someone in their family who, as you said, things change, mm-hmm. and some things that used to work don't work anymore.
Right.
How can we, I suppose, help people to come around to that thinking if they're resisting that?
Right. It's very important to also state that a lot of young people have this old ways of thinking too, because they leave school and they go to university. They think, I have the assumption, when I learn a lot, when I have my exams and diplomas, then I will be successful. But this is way of thinking. This might be true in a certain field of life, but it also might be untrue, because is getting your exams and making degrees and studying, is this a way to success? And what is success? Do you really want success? Do you want success to be famous, to be admired, or do you want success to be loved? Well, if love is the intention of success, you can just find a friend and have a friend relationship, which is a shortcut to being loved. So what do you really want in life? And these are very simple questions to ask, but often very difficult to answer. And I have the assumption that especially young people, 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, looking for what is my life about and what should I be, stuck in these very old ways of thinking, old patterns of thinking, and they can only create their own life if they are able to break free out of these expectations. So I'm actually more concerned with the younger people stuck in old patterns of thinking than the older people. Yeah.
And okay, so I hear what you're saying. Yeah, younger people who might have been told, I guess, that rhetoric that you described, you know, success is one thing, which means economic security. It means wealth status. It means having a certain job title, a certain house, a certain car. And I think a lot of young people are actually rebelling against that and actually thinking, no, you know, that model of success no longer works, but they don't necessarily have a template to replace it with. So then I think is when people feel lost, afraid, unsure, almost a bit angry as well, because it's like, okay, this template you told me this was the template. That template no longer works. But now what am I supposed to do instead? And and almost the opposite, being told, you know, minimalism is in fashion now. And, you know, true success is just being content and not wanting the approval of others. And it sounds nice, but I think it's, again, not very tangible for people. And yeah, so for those young people who maybe feel like, well, actually that old model of success doesn't work, what advice would you give to them to finding their own?
Well, this is a very important core question everybody has to deal with. And I think what helps is to shift your attention from expectations to desires. And this is also in the flip thinking theory, a very important insight. There's a big difference between an expectation, which deals with how things should be, and a desire, which deals with how, with what you want to experience. And we have thousands of expectations about everything: ourselves, our parents, our children, our family, our company we work for, clients. We have all kinds of expectations. That's fine, because this is how life works, you know. You have expectations about people being polite, and that's the right expectations you have. Expectations, we have nothing wrong with that. But if you're only looking on the expectations you have in life, how things should be, you're missing the point that life, to my conviction, is not about expectations, it's about desires. And the world of desires is very simple. We all desire, to my conviction, three things, which is commitment, to feel related to somebody else, connection, autonomy, that we can make our own decisions, that we are autonomous people, and competence, which is what Richard Ryan and Edward Deci, the two psychologists, also state. What drives people? What do people really want? And as soon as you are able to shift your focus from your expectations, how life should be, or what you have to do, to your desires, what do I want to experience in life? Life's in a way becomes very simple, because what we all desire is connection with other people, being autonomous, and being competent. Well, this raises, of course, new questions, because how can you realize commitment? How can you realize autonomy? But as soon as you know that these are the things that really drive you, that really motivate you, then you can be more creative about your expectations, because you let go of a lot of expectations, make your world more simple, and focus on what you really want.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the autonomy piece is really, really important. Think a lot of people, when they feel as though I'm doing this because I have to, not because I choose to, you know, I have to work in this place, or maybe I can't afford to go and start a business and be freelance. You know, I think that for a lot of people is a frustration, and it's not necessarily easily overcome. But I think as well, maybe, you know, that's just a career example, but I think autonomy, and again, going back to flip thinking, thinking about the things in your life which you do have autonomy over, rather than the things that you don't. So even the small things, like, for example, what you have for your breakfast in the morning, you know, if you have a nice coffee, if you go out for a walk, if you go out for a run, you know, I'm someone who I love to exercise in the morning. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is something when people say to me, oh, but I don't have time, you know, I'd love to do that, and I don't have time. And I mean, we'll talk about it later, but I think that part, the autonomy part, maybe people think they don't have autonomy, when in fact, there are some areas of their life where they do. Would you agree?
Yeah, we do have a lot of autonomy, but you, before you can grasp the force you have, the autonomy you have to be free in your mind not to live up to a lot of expectations other people have from you, and you, especially you, have for yourself. Because it's these expectations that make our life very, you know, crowded, very impossible, filled with a lot of things we actually, if we examine them, we really don't want, in essence. We think things make us happy, but if they don't, just let go. It's nice to have a lot of money, but how much money do you need? 1 million, 2 million, 3 million? When do you feel secure enough? And what is security? Because in the end, we will all die. So how much security do we need? So embracing the fact that things all come to an end, that life comes to an end, that life is not fair, that everything with a beginning has an ending. All these things are very difficult for our brain to comprehend and to find peace with. But as soon as we find peace with the the pain in life, the difficult things in life, the limitations in life, if we don't fight these anymore, then we are free. Mm. And this is in essence what Omdenken is. I find it important to state that Omdenken is not about or flip thinking, as it is in Dutch, it's Omdenken. I've been talking about Omdenken for 20 years. So for me, flip thinking is in a way a new word, but this is how it is translated in the English book. So the essence is flip thinking is not the same as optimism or positivity. There's a big difference between the two. Omdenken always starts with the acceptance that you cannot change a lot of things in life. You know, So pain, mourning, disadvantages, limitations, all belong to life. Pain is part of life, and as long as you fight this, you make things worse. This is what I call stuck thinking, making a disaster out of a problem. So your own problem, your own attempt to solve the problem makes the problem worse. Like your car is stuck in mud, you put your on the accelerator, you know, and the wheels go deeper and deeper into the mud. This is what a lot of people do. They try to solve problems, but the solution makes the problem worse. So Omdenken is not about optimism. It's about accepting the things you can change, and then find what can I do with the things that at first sight can be changed at all, like losing your hair, like the rain, you know. But although things are not in your advantage, you can investigate how can I do something with it, like an improv actor in a theater would do.
Yeah. Well, this is a very timely message for me, Berthold. So I'm going to write this down to one, to accept, you said, accepting some things you can't change.
So important.
And the other, the other one, the expectations. When you said that, I thought, actually, I'm someone, I'll be very honest, I definitely have high expectations for myself and for others. And I think there's an upside to that sometimes, but there's definitely a downside to that. So
is. And the interesting question is, do you have expectations about, you know, success or running marathons or whatever? Because you just like success and like marathons, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But if, and this is something we have to investigate for ourselves, if we think getting rich gives us more friends, if getting rich makes people admire us, if we are able to run a marathon, then we are really strong and we are able to live here on Earth because we are something, then maybe there's a negative motivator working all the time that actually you have to prove to yourself that you are allowed to live on this Earth. And to my opinion, everybody is allowed to live on this Earth because we live on this Earth. So why do we have to prove you may be here? Because you are already here, you know?
I agree. It's something that I definitely challenge myself to consider and to think about deeply. You know, I really have, especially over the last few years, because my thing was about, like some of the things you just mentioned, about achievement. And I started to think, okay, you're always trying to achieve something, whether it's, running a marathon, writing a book, starting a business, you know, buying a house. It's like achieve. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, it's not, you know, I interviewed someone and we talked about perfectionism. And I think people sometimes think, okay, this driving thing to achieve and to appear to be always improving is almost like an external thing to show other people. But actually, in my experience and what you just described, it was never actually, for me, it was never about anyone else. It was always about myself. And I think if you have, for whatever reason, grown up, you know, school, teachers, parents, thing, if you felt a lacking in yourself, it's not about wanting to be, if you felt a lacking in yourself, then you're almost forever trying to prove to yourself, I can improve, I can be better, I can be more. And it's a real challenge because, you know, I enjoy doing the things that I do, and I wouldn't change it, but I do think about it deeply. I try to always be conscious of, why are you doing this? Why are you signing up to another race? Why are you starting another challenge? Is it, I think deep down, it probably comes from a feeling of less than, and therefore when you achieve more, it's a counter to that.
Yeah, and I have a podcast in Holland too, and then I have a dialogue one-on-one with one person, starting the conversation with his or her problem, and then we try to figure out how is the problem constructed, and can we flip think the problem, can we solve it, can we let go of the problem, or just have to observe there is a problem and we can do nothing about it, we just have to live with the problem. So this is what I investigate with people in the podcast. I'm doing the podcast in English too recently, but in Dutch for a long time. So what I have found out, that behind a lot of problems, superficial problems, like with your children, in bringing children up, or with your career, or being overweight and having struggles with this. I encounter a lot of people with a lot of problems on a wide variety of things, you know. So, but what I have found out that behind these superficial problems, often there is a negative self-image. For example, when you have this negative self-image, am I a good father? Maybe I'm not that good father as I want to be. If this is your self-image, I am not a good father, then you start all kinds of actions to prove to yourself that you are a good father, like being very tough to your children and being consequent. So if this is your motivator, that you want to prove to the world and especially to yourself that you are a good father, if this is what you want, this negative self-image is constantly in the background running as an automatic program, and you won't get rid of this automatic program unless you investigate in yourself, what is my real motivator to do things? Do I just want to bring up my children as good as I can, or am I proving to myself and the world, but especially to myself, that I am a good father? Because the last motivator is a bad motivator. It's an attempt to convince yourself of the opposite of what you deeply think. So the best thing to do is to know what you think. I'm a bad father. I doubt about myself. I'm not that nice a person. I think I'm dumb. Whatever this negative self-image might be. And as soon as you dig into the ground and you find this negative self-image with what hurts, it hurts. It's like it feels like a knife in your back, you know, being revealed. It feels like being revealed, like similar to the imposter syndrome. As soon as you have found this negative self-image, then you can make a joke about it, laugh about it, make fun of it, and then let go. Just let go, because you can't solve negative self-images. You can't solve an idea of a negative identity. The only thing you can do is let go. Sometimes as a parent you're good, sometimes you make mistakes, nothing wrong with that. So it's the essence of life to shift from what you want to do instead of who you want to be. It's all about doing in life, doing, being, just being there, you are here, and doing things in freedom and with creativity.
Let's talk about something new. So we live in an abundant world. We have abundance of choice, abundance of opportunity. If we're fortunate, abundance of food, abundance of clothes, abundance, more. There's so much. And I think, of course, there is some upside to that, but there's a lot of downside to that for a lot of people. And I think people are really struggling, whether it's decision-making, whether it's relationship commitment, you know, diet, all these things. As you said, there's too much choice.
Right.
So I'm a big believer, and I know that you are too, in the power of constraints and how limits, when we limit our choices, we can make better decisions. Or when we limit the options available, it can really enhance our problem solving, our creativity. So yeah, I'd love it if you could explain to us how setting limits can enhance our lives and our ability to problem solve.
Yeah, I'm from Holland. There's a German saying that says, in der Beschränkung zeigt sich erst der Meister. So in which you might translate, in the limitation, mastery becomes visible. You know, you need a limit, you need a fence, you need the impossible to explore the possible within this field. So accepting that you can change things makes you more creative. But let me give you an example to illustrate this. In the Indiana Jones film Raiders of the Lost Ark, with Harrison Ford featuring as the leading role, there was this shooting planned with sword fights, you know, a crowd, and Harrison Ford would with his sword and fight the enemy. And so classic scene in such a movies. And they had been rehearsing for this scene for 3 weeks in America. But the shootings were in Tunisia, and on the day these shootings were planned with this sword fight scene, Harrison Ford suffered a massive attack of diarrhea. So he couldn't step one foot before the other. So the shootings as planned couldn't take place at all. So this is a problem. So how could you solve the problem? You know, by rearranging the schedule or trying to find a stand-in to do so or whatever. Just all things you could do to create the movie as planned. This is what you might call solving the problem. So problem solved. Nothing wrong with that. But what Harrison Ford did was he accepted his limitation But he did something with this limitation. So he wasn't able to fight, but he was able to do something else. And this is what he proposed to Steven Spielberg, the director of the movie. He said, what if I just shoot the bastard? And Steven Spielberg, he agreed. So, okay, let's try to film the scene this way. So there's this sword fight, and the man is waving his sword around, and he wants to start a fight, and Harrison Ford just sighs. You know, actually, I think he wants to go to the toilet, but he just sighs. he pulls his gun and he shoots him. So end of scene. The scene lasts only for 5-6 seconds. Very short scene in the movie, Indiana Jones, Raiders of Lost Ark. So the funny thing is, the nice thing is, this movie has become so iconic because of this iconic scene, because nobody. As a spectator, expects Harrison Ford to just shoot him. They all expect him to have a fair fight with swords. So this scene wouldn't be there if Harrison Ford wouldn't have suffered a last attack of diarrhea and make something out of it. So accept things. And like you said, make plan B, plan C, plan D. This is what you do in life. And this is what this has been SFA investigated. This is what optimistic people tend to do. This is what pessimistic people do. This has been investigated by Swedish scientist, Segerström, her name is. And she found out that what is the strategy of pessimistic people? They don't have plans. Then life just comes and they say, oh, it rains. Oh, I got fired. I didn't expect that. So they just live on, and everything that happens is a kind of surprise. And of course, a lot of bad things happen. This is a strategy of pessimistic people. And they're surprised continuously by disadvantages. What do optimistic people do? They expect the worst, which is counterintuitive. Because how can optimistic people expect the worst? But they expect the worst. They make plans for the worst. Like what you said at the beginning of this interview, they have plan B, plan C, plan D, plan E. The worst often doesn't happen in life. Well, bad things can happen, but the worst doesn't happen. So what do optimistic people then say? Well, it isn't that bad at all. I have made a plan for this. Nothing wrong with that. So, but this is nice, right? That pessimistic people don't have plans, and that optimistic people expect the worst. I find this counterintuitive, but this is how it works. And I think I presume you recognize this in your life, right?
I really do. That's why I'm nodding my head furiously, because you described my mother and me. So growing up, my mother is a very, I'd say, pessimistic person. She was somebody who always said she had a lot of problems in her life. Mm-hmm. She didn't really enjoy her life. She didn't enjoy her work. She didn't really enjoy motherhood. She didn't enjoy relationships. She didn't enjoy anything.
Yeah.
So her story every day was that the world is difficult. You know, like you said, if the weather's bad, oh, it's always bad. Yeah. If something happened with the car, you know, of course this happened to me. Course. You know, this would happen to me.
By the way, you are
car.
Describing my mother too, right? If I may intervene, okay. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So she couldn't, you know, we can't afford to do that, or this is too expensive, or you can't. So I think when you grow up in that environment, especially as an older sibling,
You were the oldest one.
So as a counter to that, I think I almost was the polar opposite. I had to think, come on, there has to be, you know, like you said, okay, option B, C, D. If the worst thing happens, even the worst thing,
right,
we still have to do something. So let's do this, or let's do this,
and
or let's do
and
this.
And let's be prepared. Let's be prepared.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Expect that thing to happen. Yeah.
Expect it, but then also don't surrender to, well, that's it. I always said, well, if that's the bad thing's going to happen, what do we do next? Right. Because we have to do something.
And make a plan in advantage.
Yep.
Expect and I think bad things to happen. Right.
Expect it. Yeah. And it's funny, as you said, I'm an optimist, but to expect bad things to happen doesn't sound optimistic. But I think for myself and my younger siblings, growing up from a very young age, I was that person who said, okay, we're going to make a plan and we need to have a backup plan. And then even now as an adult, I think if you were to look at, you know, the way I live my life, or things maybe that I choose to do, or even savings, things where it's like, you know, save for a rainy day because something bad could happen.
Right.
But I don't think that it will. But if it did, it would be fine.
Yeah.
You know, everything will be fine.
And
so
it will be not that bad as it could be. It will be not that bad. Yeah. But the funny thing, my mother, I started with yes, but, not with flip thinking or omnenk. I started with yes, but. And my mother was yes, but. This was her life attitude, everything, yes, but. And I don't know if it's the same like you. In your life, I have found a strategy in a way to deal with my mother. You know, she was a negative example. And I investigated how would it be to say yes and to life, which is the opposite of yes, but of course. So this is where it all started. Thanks to my mother, I was forced to be optimistic. I didn't have a choice, actually.
Yeah, same, because I had to. And I think it's funny because now I see it playing out in my daily life, sometimes probably a bit annoying for people who are beside me. For example, recently when I was flying back from Italy with my husband to the UK, we had an evening flight and we were traveling without our children the week before, because we have a blended family with three children. So the week before, we'd had three children with us. And of course, that means you've got, you know, backpacks and you've got books and snacks and things, and you need to play games and entertain them, and someone needs the toilet, all of these things. So this week, it was just me and my husband, no children. And we're coming back from Italy and the flight is delayed. And I said, it doesn't matter because, you know, it's just us two, so we can just relax.
More time.
And then...
More time.
So yeah, so it was 8 p.m. Then the flight says 9 p.m. Then the flight says 10 p.m. Okay. And we're sitting. Eventually, we did get on the flight. But by the time we get back to the UK, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning and it's late and things are closed and we're tired and we're in London. And I think it's probably annoying if you're with me and somebody wants to complain. Oh, this is so annoying. Oh, this is, you know, and I'm always the person. But it's fine. We can just, you know, we can have a drink. We can just sit in here, relax. I'm going to listen to a podcast.
That's annoying. You are really
It's annoying.
You are. Yeah, you are.
It's annoying.
It's annoying.
It's annoying, but I'm also like, what makes the situation worse? If you sit there, you get mad. This is so, you know, the flight's delayed. I'm going to be annoyed.
It doesn't help because when the flight's delayed, it's delayed. Dot. Nothing you can do about it. Yeah.
Exactly.
So, I have a life rule which really helps in these situations. It's called ISP. It sucks, period. It sucks, period. So, but there's a big difference between letting go a problem and observing that you have a problem and you cannot do anything about you. Omdenken, flipping, is not about being optimistic and always make something out of life, because if your husband or one of your children would die, this would be terrible. And this day, you wouldn't be optimistic. You would be very sad, and which would be a very normal emotional response to a tragic, you know. But what really helps in these situations is not forcing yourself to let go and just carry on life and be optimistic. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You can't solve. When somebody dies, you can solve this problem. It's a little bit too big. You know, we can't revive people until now. So what helps is the life rule, it sucks, period. And I mean with it sucks, period, what I mean with this is it really hurts. It is really a problem. You are able to tell people how much pain you feel. Nothing wrong with that. But then... Period. Don't make a problem out of the fact that you have a problem. You have a problem, and this is big, a problem enough. And what a lot of people do is what I call frustration on frustration. So they have a problem, but then they make a problem out of the fact that they have a problem. And then they think they have to let go of this, and they are not able to let go, then they want to solve it. So it's all more frustration on frustration on frustration on frustration. And why is this happening so often in life? Because the original problem can be solved at all. You know, when it rains, it rains. When somebody dies, somebody dies. So you cannot change reality. But what you do, what you are able to change is how you deal with reality. And so what helps is admitting the pain, embracing the fact that you really have a painful problem, but then it sucks, period. Don't make a problem out of the fact that you have a problem, because we all have problems. And in the end, we all will die. So that's the biggest problem we all have to face.
Yeah, true.
And then you are free, right? And then you, in a moment, you can say it sucks, period. Then you are free.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And that's the mindset piece. Again, we started at the top of the conversation. I talked about, you know, the time of the year and, you know, I suppose cultivating a mindset where you think, okay, what do I want to do? How am I going to approach it? You know, what barriers am I going to face? Let's look at it and let's take action. Let's actually do something.
Right.
Now, a lot of people, and myself included, I'm human. Okay. We struggle with self.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, exactly. So we struggle with, I think when I ask these questions, I never want to describe, oh, people this and people that. I am people, you know? Yeah. So when we suffer with negative self-talk, self-doubt, which for so many people keeps them stuck, it stops them taking action because maybe I can't do it yet. Maybe I haven't learned enough yet. Maybe I don't have the right expertise or the right people yet. You know, I'll do it one day. But the self-doubt and the self-talk, I think, holds people back for so long. So if people want to take action, if they know that self-doubt and negative self-talk is holding them back, what advice would you give them?
Well, what we all tend to do is to underestimate how resilient we are. We are capable of overcoming disadvantages or problems or hindrances. And we underestimate our capacity to deal with things. So, yeah, we are afraid. We all are. And so what helps is knowing that when you do things you are afraid of, in the process, you will learn, you will develop, you will overcome problems. And we underestimate our capacity to learn during the progress. And this is one thing that might help you. The other thing that might help you is we all make mistakes. Things go wrong. We get bankrupt. A marriage might fail. If you are afraid that something might go wrong, the best thing to do is just stay in your home and do nothing, because doing nothing, then nothing can go wrong. But things will go wrong. So accept this. Mm. Things will go wrong. There's this nice story about a Romanian guy who he thought by astrology he could predict the day he would die. So in this specific day, he stayed in his bedroom. So what happened was that part of his ceiling came down and he died. Because he wanted to escape that, death overcame him. So we all will die. We all make mistakes. Bad things will happen. Just take a deep breath. Be prepared. Have plan B, C, D ready for you. And just dive into it. And you know, yeah, this sounds maybe a little bit harsh, but in the end, we will all die. So what do we have to lose? Just start living instead of avoiding death.
Mm. Yeah, you've mentioned this a few times. You know, in the end, we're all going to die. Yeah.
And do I say it too often?
No, it's just interesting that you would say that, and we're having this conversation this week because somebody in my family actually died 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And it's the first time that my son, who is 12 now, has experienced this in his life.
Yeah.
So as you're saying it, you know, I'm obviously as a mother, you know, you're trying to help them navigate grief for the first time, trying to help them and help him understand, you know, he's really hurting, he's upset, he's angry, he's feeling all these different emotions. And, you know, I'm trying to navigate that with him and say, it's okay to feel angry, it's okay to cry, it's okay to feel frustration. Right. But then as you say, it's quite pragmatic, you know, we all must experience this in life to accept that, you know, he can't come back, or, you know, it's the first time. And I know, you know, 12 years old is different to maybe adults, but it's just interesting, you know, like you said, a few times you said it, well, people will die, we're all going to die. And I think, I don't know, making him understand that living your life, as you said, you know, living now, doing all the things, you know, the person I'm talking about, you know, they had a joyful life. And maybe, yeah, I don't know, really, it was just timely that you said that. And I've been talking a lot in the last 2 days to him about death for the first time.
But was it about a young person who died?
No, it wasn't. It was his grandfather.
But he loved his grandfather, I presume, right?
So much. And he's never, like I said, experienced anything like this before. And yeah, it's just a hard week, you know. It's hard to see that, to see him in
so much pain. To see your child in such pain, right?
Yeah.
So what helps is, this is a neighbor, a woman. She lost her man, her husband, suddenly from one day to another. So her life was a mess. And after more than 40 years of marriage, from one day to the other, what helped her was that a friend of hers said to her, it hurts so much, this hurts so much, this pain won't go the rest of your life. It won't go. And she said to me, this was the most terrifying message somebody gave me in all these times. But when I really let this message sink in and feel what it meant to me, I could see she was right. It hurt so much that fighting the pain was the problem. And accepting just the pain was the liberation. And after that, she said, when I felt pain, I just sit in a chair, I start crying, I feel sad, and in the same time, I feel unbelievably happy. And for me, I think being able to be happy and feel pain in the same time, and that one of them is not fighting the other, but they can exist in the same time. This is liberation, because your son has a lot of pain because he loved his grandfather. So the more he loved him, the more pain he will feel. So the liberating idea for him might be, if he needs to be liberated, of course, because he can feel pain, but that to embrace the pain as the flip side of the love he felt. How strange would it be if he did not feel pain? It's a very loving response to a tragedy. Mm. Nothing wrong with him. So. Just compliment him for being sad, you might say.
Yeah, you're right. And it is a difficult thing for anyone who's experiencing that. And I read something this week as I've been trying to find, you know, resources and things for me to think about, that talked about this pain of grief as talked about, you know, if you think about physical pain on your body, if you had a big cut on your arm and the cut initially, this wound is there and it's a different kind of pain and it's raw and you can't touch it and it's bleeding. And it basically said that over time, obviously, as the skin heals and the flesh heals, you have this scar.
Yep.
Now, the scar is there forever. It will never leave. So it will never go. But it's not a raw wound anymore that is this raw pain. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was also quite interesting to know that you might have this feeling, like you said with the example of the woman or with my son, you might have this scar to remember actually that pain of missing your grandfather or missing your partner forever. And it is hard to think, but it's also nice to know it's going to change. The pain's going to change. It is going to heal in some way, but it's never going to go. It will always be there.
And I think how nice could it be if you would reframe the scarf and the pain as a sign of love? Hmm. It's a sign of love.
Yeah.
And the worst thing you can do if there's a wound and if it's healing is to, you know, how do you say this in English? If you want to intervene with the process and you know, these things that are, you know, I don't know the English word. I'm
like a scab.
Is it a scab? Scab,
we call it.
These little dark red things that develop on your skin too. I'm looking for a very simple word. What's the word? Gosh.
The word in English is a scab. Okay. It's a not very nice word, a scab. So the thing, like you said, if it heals and if you take it off, it's going to have to start again.
Right. So, and this is what we all tend to do. We want to speed the process by putting this away. But by putting it away, the natural healing process will be prevented. We will just wait and do nothing. Just do nothing. Things heal out of themselves. This is, I've in the book, the Flip Thinking book, I have 15 strategies. One of the strategies is the strategy of waiting. Do nothing. In life, we have this basic idea that if we want to change reality, we have to do things. But if we want to change reality, we can also do purposely nothing and just wait and see, because things might change in their advantage, and if they do so, by intervening, we're intervening this process. So doing nothing, which the Chinese describe this as wu wai, it's a Chinese saying, doing by not doing. And this is something in the West, in our society, is very difficult. We have this basic idea, like I said, if you want to change reality, do something. So if you want to change reality, do nothing. This is something we are unfamiliar with. Yeah. Doing nothing is...
But it's a conscious... What you're describing is conscious choice to do nothing.
Right, right.
As opposed to people think, oh, if I do nothing, of course I have to choose. But a conscious choice to do nothing is saying, I am going to do nothing and I'm going to just wait and see.
Right,
and
right.
let, as and you
which,
said, let
which
things
Which is a very, very
happen.
Active active way of dealing with reality. Consciously doing nothing and being aware of that you are doing this. Yeah, it's not passive. No.
I find that incredibly difficult. Even the word patience, I feel like even the word patience, I'm like, I don't have patience. I know it's something I would always
try patient,
to do.
The word patient makes you impatient immediately.
Exactly, exactly. And I know it's something that I should try and I will continue to probably whole life.
But you know, because you're trained for a marathon, right? For long running. This is what I've listened to some of your podcasts and very nice, by the way. But you know this because when you are training, your body needs rest to grow, to develop. So in sleeping, your body is becoming stronger. So you know by training that doing nothing makes you better.
Yeah.
Okay, but doing this in real life is important. This is difficult too. I know. Yeah.
It's a bit difficult, but I think, I don't want to speak too soon, but in some areas of my life, I think I'm perhaps finally getting better at saying, okay.
Oh, you're still young, right? How old are you, if I may ask so?
I'm 35.
Oh, a lot of years to go to become more patient.
Yeah. Yes, I hope so. Well, I love this conversation. I really didn't expect, in all honesty, to share so much, especially with the death in the family this week. But yeah. I just enjoyed, this conversation kind of just, it came to be. So my final part of the show, I always talk to my guests about the Power Hour, mm-hmm. of course, mm-hmm. about the first hour of each day, why they do what they do, what time do people wake up? Is there something that they have this special routine, or is it that you do nothing, you just wake up and do it? So yes, Berthold, could you tell us, what does the first hour, your Power Hour, typically include each day?
I've been thinking about this question in preparation of this podcast. I have an evening routine, and my evening routine is that I look back at the day that has gone, but I'm looking forward to the day that that is there. So in the evening, I'm contemplating about the next day, what things gives me joy, pleasure, fun, energy, and what things are just irritating things that have to be done, like mowing the grass or whatever, things that has to be, or paying the bills. Or so the night before, I make a vision of the next day, and I take care that before I get to sleep, I really enjoy the next day. And I think this is what I dream about. This is what my brain unconsciously is working on. So the next day I'm getting up, I'm just awake and the lights turn on and I'm energetic and start the day. So I can just start by contemplating about the day before.
Mm. Yeah. No, that makes complete sense, because you're not waking up thinking, what do I have to do first?
No.
What do I have to? You've already made the plan, and you're ready to go.
I'm excited, or motivated to do the things you have to do. Yeah.
Mm. And you mentioned in this episode your age. Can you tell us again how old you are?
64, which is
The reason I ask you is because you just mentioned then you have motivation in the morning to do the things. Yeah. You have the energy. You're vibrant. Why do you think, or what advice, I suppose, would you give? You're somebody who is 64.
Okay.
You still have energy and motivation for new things in life.
I have. I think be like a mule. You know, mules, when you know a mule, when you want a mule to go to the left, what does a mule do? It stays on its place, or it goes to the right. Mules don't cooperate. So I think I'm, in a way, like a mule. In my whole life, and this is what my father told me, in my whole life, when I did things I didn't want to do, I always knew I didn't want to do them. And so a lot of things you have to do. I had to go to school like everybody else, but I hated school. I really hated it. Not because school was in itself annoying. It was annoying. But later on, I found out that during the times I was obliged to sit on a chair and listen to somebody else, I did not have time to develop my own life. So school prevented me from living my own life. This is what I only found out later. So I hated school, not because I had to do things, but I couldn't do other things. So my father had taught me, and this is a lesson I always kept with me, it's all about what you really want in life. And if you don't want to do something, just don't do it. So during my career, I work with homeless people, I work with children run away from their parents. I've done a lot of volunteer work. During 20 years of my life, I was quite poor, didn't have that much money, but it was just fine. I didn't need a car. I could drive a bicycle or just go walking. So money was not that big a topic in my life. It always was about, what do I want to do? You know, what do I want to do? And as soon as I experienced myself in a situation where I don't want to do something anymore, I just quit. The only important question is, what makes me happy? What makes me tick? And if you know something doesn't make you happy anymore, just stop it, investigate it, and just stop it. And a lot of people are living on a kind of automatic pilot because this is how life is, this is what you should do. But if you dare to look at what you really want, and if you are a little bit brave, because you need a little bit bravery to make bold decisions, but if you focus on what you want instead of what is expected of you, then your career, like my career did, it's continuously moving, and new things are coming up, and all things I didn't like. But this is my this is my lifeline, you might say, to stay young and feel energetic. And you don't have to do anything in life. It's about what you want to do.
Wow, inspiring. What a great place the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for being here. How was my English? Was it okay enough?
Much better than my Dutch.
Well, thank you for the compliment.
Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. As always, I appreciate it, and I will be back next week with another episode.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.